Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Ira Harris and Daniel Lacalle. Ira is an independent trader, successful hedge fund manager, global macro consultant trading foreign currencies, bonds, commodities, and equities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003. And Daniel is an investment manager and has been a professor of economics. He has a PhD in economics, author of Escape from the Central Bank Trap, Life in the Financial Markets, and The Energy World is Flat. He writes frequently at the Mises Institute. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you so much. A pleasure.
Great. Today, I thought we'd do a focus on Europe, what's happening in Europe, the parliamentary elections, and tying that into some recent writings that both of you have done. We can also touch upon the Chinese-U.S. trade frictions. So maybe to begin with, we get your views on all of the elections that have been happening this past week, looking like a strong move to nationalist-based parties, and what your thoughts are on the effects of what this means towards the economies in Europe as well as the financial markets. Ira, would you like to begin?
In discussing the elections, I think the biggest part of the election story now comes, of course, we're going to all talk about the horse trading. But from my perspective, the most important element should be, and I'm not sure how Daniel, whether he'll agree with this or not, but that Jens Weidmann should become the ECB president. And my view on that, and it hasn't changed in several years, but I believe the same back in 2011, that Merkel succumbed to the charms of Sarkozy and settled. And it was a mistake, because I think it's important for Europe that a German were to head this ECB now. Mm-hmm. Because you have to get the German populace to buy in full force into everything that the European Union wants to accomplish. And if you don't have a German, I think running the bank, it'll be bad for German domestic political politics. So better to have somebody, especially of the caliber of Jens Weidmann. And that will be the very important element, because, you know, if we look at the fallout of how this all ends, Mario Draghi has built, with Angela Merkel's blessings and others, a massive balance sheet in his whatever it takes scenario. What happens to that balance sheet? I think the highest probability is going to be that it gets folded into a euro bond, which is what the mainstays of the European project want anyway. So you may as well have a German at the head, and I'll stop there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I actually quite agree with what you're saying. I think that it is what these elections have shown is. It's two things, I believe. One is that there is an important rise in the number of seats taken by Eurosceptic or nationalistic parties. So, and that is, I think, very evident in countries that have seen very, very weak growth and the constant erosion of purchasing power from the monetary policy. So you've seen it in Italy, you've seen it in France, you've seen it also in Germany, even in Spain, no? So I think that the first take is obviously that there's been a very significant rise in the populist, I don't like to call it populist, in the nationalistic parties. The second point is that these elections have been about everything except monetary policy. It's been very interesting to see in the debates that there have been very, very few comments in the debates about monetary policy, about the role of the European Central Bank. And you're very right. The European Central Bank balance sheet right now is about 40% of the GDP of the Eurozone. At the peak of the QE, the US, the Federal Reserve Central Bank, was less than 26% of the GDP of the US. So there is very important that, as you very well said, that the next president of the European Central Bank is a German official. And the reason for it is because the European Central Bank is already moving to some form of monetization or Eurobond, because it cannot buy more sovereign debt, but it is buying every maturity, and therefore it's putting a lot of pressure on sovereign bond yields and on spreads. As such, if the Germans, who are not very keen on full monetization of debt, etc., see the helm of the European Central Bank under somebody else that is not a German, it can definitely create some tension in the euro.
And you've recently written an article called ECB's Monetary Trap, Daniel, in which you describe what's happening in Europe in general, and as far as what the objective, as you see, that the ECB is looking to make public spending cheap to finance, and a sort of financial repression. Can you elaborate on that?
Yes. The ECB launched the quantitative easing program as a tool to improve the possibilities of government to undertake structural reforms. However, in this process, what has happened is that governments have grown accustomed to very low interest rates and cheap debt, and what they've done is the opposite. And if you look at the general result of the European elections, what the main parties that have won are demanding is more deficit spending, more government spending. So the ECB finds itself in a monetary trap, because on one side, if it stops its policy, if it stops the low rate purchasing of maturities program that they have right now, what ends up happening is that you would see a massive rise in spreads and yields in the Eurozone that could rock the economy very, very quickly. On the other hand, if it doesn't stop, and if it continues to do what it is doing, instead of buying time for governments to undertake structural reforms, what it is actually doing is whitewashing the populist agenda, which is that government spending should be fully monetized and that there is no problem in massive deficit spending.
And you mentioned a lot of this basis is that there is no apparent inflation. But as you point out, there's been a lot of inflation since 2000. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, no, this is super. This is actually quite humorous, because if you think about it, the European Central Bank, most of the economists, most of the consensus is telling us that there is no inflation in the Eurozone, and as such, monetary policy can be as accommodative and as dovish as needed for as long as it's needed. However, at the same time, you have every week in France demonstrations of the yellow vests. And what are they demonstrating against? The rise in prices, the rise in consumer prices, the cost of living. And in the recent polls undertaken by the Eurozone, one of the second biggest concern of households after unemployment is the cost of living. So it is a complete fallacy that there is no inflation in the Eurozone. And more importantly, there is there is quite a substantial amount of inflation. Prices have risen, as I mentioned in my article, 40% since 2000, whilst productivity and salaries have barely risen.
And your thoughts, Ira, on the ECB's monetary trap and the perspective of Daniel?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And that's my point about why they need a German to head up the bank. And I see that Daniel seems to come at it the same way. Look, I had a conversation yesterday with first time I'd ever talked to him, but I've respected him for 40 years, 35 years, Mr. Zuloff. So we had a nice long conversation. And I raised the same issue with him, and we're having this discussion. And I said, look, if you follow the work of Carmen Reinhart, which I think is very important, on financial repression, which, of course, is who sponsors this podcast, Financial Repression Authority, nobody in the world has been as financially repressed as the German citizen because of their culture of saving. I mean, it's just the way it is. They really don't. When the Germans did step up to speculate in stock markets, they ran right head first into the Neuer market back in 1999, 2000, 2001. They have the lowest housing ownership because they don't borrow. They don't borrow to buy houses. It's just not as common. So here you have, if I'm a German saver, and let's say that I'm in short money. So I'm getting negative 50 basis points, 40 basis points, 30 basis, whatever. It's negative. And inflation in Germany, I don't care what it is in the rest of the Eurozone. I live in Germany, and we know that that's where it manifests itself. And with Merkel's ridiculous energy program, which has driven up energy costs, I have suffered tremendously in order to bail out everybody else. So if the fact that I've been so financially repressed, as a Bavarian burger, and I've not been able to vote for any of this. Nobody's ever asked me. Even Ottmar Issing in that piece in the Financial Times talked about, taxation without representation. And of course, financial repression is certainly a form of taxation. So I need to see Jens Weidmann. I want Jens Weidmann because I have to feel that somebody's actually looking out for me. Right now, nobody's looking out for me. Yes, I know Germany has benefited from a weaker currency because the Deutschmark would have been very, very strong. But that's just not, that's an asset as well as a liability. So Danielle is 100%. I can't agree with him more. And it's the monetary trap and Draghi following more importantly, Bernanke than the Japanese, whether it was Kuroda or Shirakawa, has walked into this, and he has no exit. So the exit, of course, has to be to create the folding the entire ECB balance sheet into a euro bond. I've looked at this, and I'm sure Daniel, there's no other way out of this, and it builds every day. And now, of course, they're buying corporate bonds, which, Jim Grant had a wonderful piece in Barron's over the weekend about it. You know, that the ECB has been the enabler of French corporate takeovers because money's so cheap. And that's exactly right. And I'll end on that because one thing that the Brits are not doing intelligently is they can get the ECB to fund the entire Hinkley Point nuclear project at basically zero interest rates by just selling the damn bonds to the ECB. You know, the French would never balk at it because EDF would love for that to happen. So the Brits ought to do that before they leave and saddle them with the entire cost of it.
Your thoughts on that, Daniel?
That is actually it's a very, very good point. You mentioned this concept of of Germany benefiting from a weaker euro, which has been used quite, you know, extensively by consensus as the main benefit for Germany of being in the monetary union. However, you're absolutely right. Who's been the other side of that trade and who has been out of that? It's been savers, no? And on one side, the German savers have been massively and negatively impacted by a weaker currency and obviously the low interest rates, but also the households, consumers have seen a very important rise in consumer prices. The energy bill has driven power prices to more than double for households. And as you very well say, because they don't borrow massively like the Spaniards or like the Italians to buy property, what ended up happening as well is that you have riots, well, not riots, but demonstrations in Berlin because rental prices are going through the roof. So the way out for the ECB is evidently some form of rolling the balance sheet into a euro bond. Absolutely it is. There is very little else that can be done. However, how do you sell this to a European Union in which the level of mistrust between nations has increased when you have the peripheral countries trying to go back to 2008 and have large deficits, even break the European Union? You have had even as recently as a year ago, you had the president of the current vice president of Italy, Mr. Salvini, talking about the possibility of breaking off the euro. So a euro bond on one side is the solution. On the other side, it's a massive time bomb because if it is successfully launched, what would happen would be that peripheral countries would be screaming for that Eurobond to be extended to current deficit financing. And on the other hand, if it doesn't, it would be entirely a liability for the German household. It is not an easy option. And I think that is why you need to find a way in which with a new president of the ECB, you implement some sort of process in which responsibility and shared responsibility comes also with some form of guarantee that it's going to be effectively implemented.
You mentioned also, Daniel, that there are 16 10-year sovereign bonds in Europe now showing negative real yields. Do you see that condition as persisting or maybe getting worse?
I think it'll get worse. I personally think it'll get worse because as we were mentioning before, the problem of it's very easy to enter into aggressive quantitative monetary policy. Very easy to print money. It's very difficult to get out. And it's very difficult to get out when you have three factors in the Eurozone that differentiate the real economy from, for example, the US. No? In the Eurozone, 80% of the real economy is financed by the banking system. In the US, it's not even 20%. Therefore, shocks in the banking system have massive impact on unemployment, on growth, on credit for SMEs, you name it. The second factor is the level of government spending at a country and at a European Union level. Government spending and government liabilities is very, very high. And the reason why it's very high is also because you have a massive and growing liability on the pension side. So One of the things that so on one side you have the banking system, which is still very fragile, financing a large part of the real economy. On the other side, you have the very high levels of government spending and governments that you know basically a 1% increase in government debt expense in the Eurozone would mean that deficits would balloon in those 17 countries. But the third factor is also very important, is that 80% of gross capital formation in the Eurozone is recycling of capital. Therefore, you're not having a dynamic capital expenditure that is driving new technologies, new economy, etc. Productivity growth is very poor, and overcapacity remains very high. So that third factor that leads to a very, let's say, perverse incentive from both governments and the ECB to Japanize the economy, to sort of keep it stagnant, but let's say painless.
And your thoughts, Ira, on negative real yields in Europe?
Well, I think that's absolutely right. And you see how it's crushing the banking industry in Europe. The worst performing stocks for 30 years have been the Japanese banks. And that's been with a lot of the banks, you know, being destroyed in Japan. So you'd think, you know, based on the concept of an oligopoly, at least, that their profit margins would be great. But of course, the central banks has destroyed that. And as Danielle points out, of course, Europe is a much more banking sensitive based economy, not corporate bonds, although the ECB is through their benevolent actions creating more corporate bonds because it's in the incentives for a lot of corporations to entertain that. But it's, you look at the banks, you know, listen, the crown jewel of European banking was Deutsche Bank. That doesn't even bring a laugh. You know, the Spanish banks have recovered somewhat from the terrible situation they were in. The Italian banks will never know what the real story is there because, especially under, you know, Basel rules, when this is one of the great feedback loops of all times, is because Basel rules, sovereign debt is zero risk weighted. So I'm UniCredit or I'm Siena, whatever. I'm loading up on Italian sovereign debt because I earn a decent return relative to everything else. And I don't have to reserve for them. So it's a beautiful relationship. In fact, I actually asked Jaime Coruna that question. I said when he was at the Bank of Spain, of course, he was in favor of zero risk weightings. But I asked him, I said, well, now you're at the BIS. Do you have a different viewpoint on that? And he started laughing because the answer, of course, is self-evident. This is a giant, giant mistake, but it's more part of what Danielle calls the money trap, and it is a money trap. And of course, Draghi can't really get out of there fast enough. You know, October 31st can't come quick enough because it's going to be very difficult, just like it was, you know, for Yellen and now certainly for Jerome Powell in trying to exit from this strategy that is very difficult to exit from. And they really had no exit plan, you know. And I think it's really worse for Europe. And that's what they're caught in. And if you look at the Europe, nothing says it better than the stock valuations of European debt.
And Ira, you frequently made reference to the book by Bernard Connolly called The Rotten Heart of Europe. Bernard mm-hmm. Connolly used to be a senior economist with the Brussels Commission. How do you see what he foresaw in that book to what's happening now in Europe?
As I say, you know what? All you do is have to read the four. He wrote the book in 1995. He updated it with a new forward in 2012, 2013. if you read that, you'll have to go get a nice scotch and sit back and think about this through, because everything he talked about has come to fruition. Unfortunately, he's not proud of that, by the way, because I know Bernard well. So he's not proud of that. Yeah, and it's always worried him. And this is where it sits. And, you know, everybody points to, you know, ridiculous things. You know, they worry about ridiculous things. Of course, the Financial Times, which used to be a good newspaper, has become a joke, because they just sit there and nod in agreement with whatever comes out of Brussels and don't challenge it. The fact that this election, the biggest issue, or of course what they wanted to make the biggest issue, was nationalism and anti-immigration. I would argue vehemently that the rise of the Alternative for Deutschland, and it's actually had its beginnings in 2013 in response to what the ECB actions were. So, and this is going to get worse, because these are pocketbook issues, and the pocket, and nobody has an answer for it. And fiscal, as long as the Germans remain reticent about fiscal austerity, or at least fiscal, let me say more importantly, fiscal responsibility. Yeah, I mean, you see it as we're sitting here right now, Rome and Brussels is going back and forth. And I'm willing to bet that as much as, you know, people think that Brussels is going to place a fine upon Rome, it'll never happen. Can't happen, because the Italians, you know, you got to give Salvini his due, because he understands, you know, he gives power to the old saying, if you owe the bank $100, they own you. If you own the bank $1 billion, you own the bank. So that's exactly what's going on here. And the Italians are not foolish. They understand. And I really think that Salvini must meet all the time with Yanis Varoufakis, because he explains to him, because he was very upset when Alexis Tsipras sold out the entire movement to get whatever he could out of Brussels. But Salvini's going, there's nothing you can do to us. They're going to run a much bigger deficit. They have to. They've got no choice. So that's where it lies. And going back to Bernard Conley and the Rotten Heart of Europe, which is still the most important book. I'm sorry if I hurt anybody's feelings about Europe. It still has relevance. And the players that he talked about 20 years ago, 25 years ago, are still heavily involved in this now. So the book still has great relevance.
And your thoughts, Daniel?
No, I completely agree with what Salvini is doing. I was in Italy recently, and there was a TV debate about this whole to and fro between Brussels and the Italian government. And one of the members of the Liga was saying, hold on a second. You mean that we're going to get a 4 billion euro fine for having the same deficit as Spain? You know what I mean? It's become a system of perverse incentives, because on one side you say, oh, you cannot exceed the deficit and you cannot break the rules agreed at Maastricht, etc. However, France has missed those same targets 11 times. Germany itself as well. And France, for example, has not had a balanced budget since the late 70s. So the problem of the Eurozone has absolutely nothing to do with a lack of government spending. The problem of the Eurozone's very poor productivity, very undynamic growth, and very weak levels of employment comes from the excess of government spending. And obviously, yes, they will run larger deficits. As you very well said, there's no other option, because Italy has been stagnant for two decades, France as well. But ultimately, the issue here is is that going to solve anything? And the Germans will finance that deficit. At the end of the day, it's a bit of a sort of vendor financing type of situation. But if you think about it from the perspective of whether that is going to help the Eurozone countries' economies improve in productivity and therefore in salaries, improve in competitiveness and improve in growth, unfortunately, it won't. Yes, you will deficit spend more current spending in subsidies and in malinvestment, but unfortunately, that is not the solution. The point that you mentioned before is that at least you will sort of hide the risk of European banks under the rug of the ECB. That's as much as you do. But unfortunately, I don't think that Italy running a larger deficit is going to move the country into growth, because it's been running a massive deficit for many, many years, and it hasn't. Mm-hmm.
And finally, a question on the global trade. How do you see the U.S.-China trade frictions and their effects on the financial markets and the global economy? And also, do you see intensifying U.S.-European trade frictions as well? Mm-hmm. Daniel?
Now, how do I see this? I was explaining this to my students the other day. If you have a company and you have the biggest supplier of your company, how do you treat your biggest supplier? You treat your biggest supplier with a little bit of tightening. You demand discounts. And if somebody is your biggest client, you take them for dinner, you treat them nice, you send them presents for Christmas. So what is happening right now is exactly that, is the negotiation between the largest customer and the largest supplier. And what I see is that the rhetoric of consensus is blaming the global slowdown and the problems of the Eurozone, the problems of different economies, on something that has absolutely nothing to do with it, which is this trade dispute between the US and China. The first reason is because people perceive that the trade dispute between the US and China is something that is hindering the growth in the rest of the world. And it is not. There is absolutely zero evidence that China is importing less from the rest of the world than it needs. Actually, there's all the evidence that it is importing a lot more. China has a trade deficit with most of the rest of the world. The second thing is that there is this perception that if there was an agreement between the U.S. and China, it would be an agreement that would sort of kick back the growth mode in the global economy. We tend to forget that if there is an agreement between the U.S. and China, it is a zero-sum game. If China starts importing more soya from the U.S., it means importing less from Argentina, because again, there is no evidence that China is importing less than what they need. Actually, there's all the evidence that they are importing more than what they need in order to boost GDP, and it's evident in the inventory build. The same with natural gas. If China imports more natural gas from the US, that will mean less natural gas imported from Qatar. So what I'm trying to get to is that this dispute is a negotiation, and that this negotiation there will be an agreement reached. However, a lot of the excess valuations of the market, excess risk taking of the market, etc., was predicated on the idea that that an agreement between the US and China would sort of change the global trend of growth. I think it's not going to do it. The impact on global markets we're seeing right now is obviously you get the froth out of the cyclicals, you get very low 10-year sovereign yields, so you have a flight to safety. And I think that basically just the trade war has been used as a subterfuge, because either we have been in a trade war since the early 2000s. Remember, we all of us here remember, for example, the aluminum war between the Bush administration. What Obama did with, for example, solar panels, all these things. Either we have been in a trade war since 2000, or we're not in a trade war now. What we have now is let's say, a less diplomatic negotiation. Will the U.S. go after some of the U.S. own imbalances afterwards, after reaching an agreement with them? You bet they will. You bet it will. And the reason for it is the reason is what I always explain to everyone. You go around, you go down the street here in Madrid or in London or in Germany, any city in Germany, any city in France. Tell me how many U.S. cars you see.
And your thoughts, Ira?
We're in very much agreement. I think this issue is it's far more, of course, in trade, and it's long overdue. You have to look to Bob Lighthizer, who's been screaming about the China's entry into the WTO, which of course was all laid by the Clinton administration, and the way that they were done and the rules that were crafted and the way that China has skirted around what the WTO's true intentions were on certain issues. And it's been long overdue. But, American corporations and American business are not, just like European business, by the way, is not without some liability in this, because they were willing to, quote-unquote, sell their souls for access to 1.3 billion consumers.
Absolutely.
Anything to get into that market. Yeah. And so, they knew what the rules were going in. They just didn't believe them. And I always, hearken back to 2009 when Jeffrey Immelt, who was then, CEO and chairman of GE, GE started pulling out of some businesses because they realized they couldn't make any money in China. It was very difficult. You had to give a lot in the partnerships. So they realized then it was not working out. So these are things that some of them have been corrected, but everybody went into China knowing what the rules were or not. So, and the Chinese, have been very astute. So let me pick up more where Danielle, which is, because I keep saying this to people, if you're right about the outcomes of China, then you should be buying Mexico.
Yeah.
And as bad as Mexico can be with all its corruption, the whole concept of NAFTA, which we're revisiting too, was that they would build a North American behemoth of Canada, the U.S., and Mexico, big population, and it would ensure that there would be wage pressure on U.S. unions to keep American somewhat, competitive on that basis. And the Chinese disrupted it because January 1st, when NAFTA, 1994, when NAFTA began, that's the day the Chinese devalued the yuan from 5.8 to 8.7. Yeah. They knew full well what the intentions were. And of course, that's created the Asian contagion, because you had all this capacity built in Thailand and Malaysia and Indonesia, Hong Kong, Taiwan. You had massive amounts of capacity. And now the Chinese were doing their best to disrupt the whole thing anyway, which they did. And you created what came 4 years later. And, of course, Mexico suffered immediately with the what did they call that? The tequila crisis? But if you believe that this has staying power, and you're a large global corporation, a multinational corporation, if we still use that word, when I was in school, that was the essence of my research was multinational corporations. That was the 70s. Then it's time for massive investments into Mexico. And actually, AMLO, who is from the political left, he understands what's going on. Can you get the corruption under under control? Hopefully he can, because he has a huge popular mandate. But I would look to Mexico. Mexico will tell me more about what people really think than anything else, because there it is in those maquiladoras that sit on the northern border of Mexico, the southern border of the U.S., were built to be the key focal point of the global supply chains, which China basically uprooted by design. So there are things that we don't have to guess at this. If we watch to see what's going on, we'll have a pretty good idea. Right now, you know, it's not telling me. I look at the peso. I look at what's going on in Mexico, Mexicana. It wants to happen, but you're not seeing it yet. You're not seeing it yet. I think some people are pulling out of China because they're fearful. So they're moving some factories, of course, to Vietnam and Thailand and Malaysia again. But we'll see what happens. But if you look at the value of the peso relative to when the yuan was devalued by 50%, the peso then I think was about 3.3 to the dollar. It, of course, is 19 to the dollar. So there's all kinds of advantages to be. But let's see if they actually work out. I think it's a little early to make that decision, but it is worth watching, and it will tell us more about global trade, because Danielle's point about, hey, you know what? So if you don't buy soybeans from the U.S., you buy them from Argentina. Somebody will buy the U.S. soybeans. But it's, you know, it's the same again with LNG. But of course, in the LNG issue, a lot of those are long-term contracts, because there's a lot of Asian financing that went into build those huge complexes down in the on the Gulf Coast. So, and with that comes contractual agreements. So a lot of that LNG has to go to Asia. It's not like Trump would say, "Oh, we're going to sell it to Europe." No, you're not. There are long-term structural agreements that you have to adhere to. So, but there's a lot of things going on, and they're really worth watching. And now I have to go read Danielle's work, because I'm not familiar with it, but this conversation has really elevated that for me. So thank you.
Well, thank you.
Great. This has been great insight and a fascinating discussion. How can our listeners learn more about your work, Danielle?
Well, the easiest way is to go to my website, dlacalle.com. That is dlacalle.com. And obviously, you can find my books on Amazon, and you can also follow me on Twitter, dlacalle_IA. I repeat, dlacalle_IA.
Great. And Ira?
You know what? Where I'm writing, and as usual, is Notes from Underground. But you can go to Ira, Yra Harris, HARRIS.com, and register for it. It's free. There's a lot of great discussion that comes from people all over the world. It's all about discourse and ideas. And of course, you know, where Danielle's in the classroom, I'm in the trading arena and investment arena. So we try to beat concepts around and try to create very profitable opportunities for trading and investing. That's what our goal is. There's no political agenda. There's nothing else but trying to generate profitable trades. And if that's what your designs are, then it's the right place for you to come and join the discussion.
Great. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you. Pleasure.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only, and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.